Okay, we're beginning here on Nundalat Amud Aleph, 8 lines down. The Gemara here is bringing a number of cases, all of them very similar in nature, which is an attempt by an individual to take possession of the property, and then the possible failure of that attempt because it doesn't qualify as a chazakah. Yesterday we dealt with two cases, one case where he throws the seed into the crack, and then it grows into something. And then the case after that we dealt with pruning the palm tree, whereby if he prunes it for the benefit of the palm tree, he will acquire the property. Whereas if he's pruning the tree to get the branches to feed to his animals, in that case he will not take possession of the property. The chazaka has to relate to a tikkun, an improvement in the property. The way that the Rashbam qualifies it, it says this, the person who comes along and tries to just pick the fruits off of the tree and not improve the tree itself, lo yavi chazaka, kishemachzik shelo midatami. Because like a person who's taking possession without really thinking about it or knowing about it, their intent is to pick the fruits off the tree. Their intent is not to improve the property or take possession of the property. What happens if he stipulates that specifically, that I want to take possession of it with the picking of these fruits? It's like somebody walking through the middle of the shuk, that I want to take possession of a certain property while he's walking through the shuk. You can't just articulate, you have to do something. And here's what the Rashbam says, the tarte baina. You need two things in order to acquire the property. Number one, she has said tikkun bakarka biyadayim, that you have to have physical interaction with the property, whereby you make an improvement in the property itself. Number two is, and then you went through that action, you have to have in mind or articulate the fact that you want to take a chazaka. So if you fail on either one of those, which is if you take an action that's not improving the property, even you want, though you say, I want to establish a chazaka through that, it won't work. It fails because the action itself is not significant or the right action. On the other hand, if you do the right action and you don't have dots to acquire, that also will fail. So these are the basic tenets that the Rashbam lays out as to when or where you can take possession of the property. Alright, so the Baalei HaTosafot over here ask a fundamental question, and they explain like the Rashbam, that the same thing, Delolam Lokani Alim Ke Mitkaven Liknot. Unless you have Kavanah to acquire, you will not acquire. The Baalei HaTosafot say, why is this different than Chatzer Shel Adam? Chatzero Shel Adam, a person's property, is able to acquire on his behalf, even if he lacks knowledge. I mean, even if he doesn't know about it, his chatzer acts on his behalf. We've seen two derachim and how to explain that. Either because your chatzer mishum yad, the chatzer is an extension of you, or chatzer is mishum zachin, zechut, that you have zachin shvedam shalo bifanav. So for one of those two reasons, your chatzer is successful at acquiring even without you knowing about it, without knowledge. So he says, why don't you say the same thing over here? If it's to the benefit of the party, that if he takes this action, and had he had in mind to acquire it, he would have acquired it. Why don't we say he acquires it because your chatzer or your action can act on your behalf, even without your knowledge. Here the Baalei HaTosafot make a fundamental distinction and say, Ve'en lakshot, da'af agav de'en da'te ashtora amai en yado konelo, shalom midato kmo chatzero, the chatzer mitorat yad itrabi. This is Tosafot d'shitato, that chatzer works mishum yad. That's why he has an issue with ketanim. In terms of chatzerot, da'ach chatzer kono lo shelo midato, what does it mean that your chatzer works without your knowledge? Hainu she'eni yodeya imhu b'chatzerot. He doesn't know, or he doesn't know what is in his chatzer. Vim haya yodeya, haya rotze liknot. But if he was aware of it, he would want to take possession of it. Aval im yodeya ve'en mitkaven liknot, lo kani. But if you know about it, and you have no intent to acquire, then it fails. So what the Baalei HaTosafot say, it depends on what information you're missing. In the case of the chatzer, what you're missing is the information that the object is there, or that something is happening that you need to engage with. So your chatzer can make up for that deficit of your lack of knowledge, and it will acquire on your behalf, because had you known about it, you would have acquired it, or you would have wanted to acquire it. So the chatzer makes up for that deficit. What you can't have here is the deficit here is that you're not intending to acquire at all. You know about the object, and you have no intention to acquire. That failure cannot be made up with, oh, we'll take care of it for you, don't worry about it. That is not something that can be made up, because you are aware of the object, you're aware of the kinyan, and you're failing to do it in a proper manner. So those are little background to the cases that we're speaking about because all of a similar nature. The last thing is that the Rishbam, at the end of these cases, makes a note here that Chol HaChazakot Alalu, all these chazakot that are mentioned in the list we did yesterday and we're going to do today, Ben Benichse Ager, that's whether you're trying to take possession inside of the property of a ger that's hefker, Ben Bematana, whether it's a gift, Ben Bemecher, or in a case where there's a transaction, a sale, V'achin Shechalku, or brothers that are splitting up in the estate. The Rishbam sees all of these chazakot here as being mechanisms for acquisition in all types of interactions. No matter what the interaction is, these are mechanisms for acquisition. There are those that definitely argue on the Rishbam and say that in the context of our Gemara is speaking about Nechse Ager. We'll see at the end, today, later in the daf, it's clear that we're speaking about Nechse Ager. In the cases before, we were also speaking about Nechse Ager. So there are many that think that these chazakot are all speaking about cases of Nechse Ager, where there is no dat makneh, where there's nobody giving you the item, nobody trying to pass the acquisition into your possession, or there's no awareness of other parties. So there you're trying to now acquire something from hefker, and that's why you need all of these trappings or all of these issues are meaningful. But in the context of mecher, or in the context possibly of matana as well, there maybe these would not work, or these aren't relevant in those situations. But here you see that the Rishbam clearly thinks it applies across the board, and these aren't unique to an acquisition of the property of the ger, but these are chazakot that one can use to acquire a property in any circumstance. And again, those that disagree think this is only by Nechse Ager. So now here's the next case. Amar Shmuel. Haiman de Zachi Zichya. One who goes and clears. The word Zachi in Aramaic is taher, is to cleanse or to remove. What he's doing is he's clearing the property. So Zachi Zichya, he's picking out the weeds. He's picking up the loose sticks and wood that is on the property. Adaita the aro, if he's doing it to improve the land, to clear the land, then koni, then he has an acquisition here because he did something to improve the land, plus he had kavanah to be acquiring it. Adaita the tzive, if he's doing it for the wood, he's collecting it because he needs wood for his fireplace, lo koni, he does not acquire it. Gemara says, hey chidami, how do we know what his intent is? Again, these are situations like the ones before where it happens memela, which is that if you collect the wood for the wood, in the end, the field is cleared. And the other way around, when you clear the field, you might take the wood and use it for the fire. So our question is, how do you know what his primary intent is in these cases? So Shako Rabbeve Vizutre, if he takes the large pieces of wood and the small kindling, Adaita Da'aro, then he's trying to clear the property off, because he's not just taking what's easy to take or what would be useful to him in terms of the wood, he's trying to completely clear the property. So in that case, we would assume that he's doing it for the benefit of the property, or that's his primary intent. Shoko Rabrave Vishabak Zutre, if he takes the larger pieces of wood or the bigger, easier pieces to grasp, and he leaves the smaller stuff behind, Adaita Ditzive, then he's clearly taking it for the firewood because he's leaving behind things that will be a little bit problematic for the field. And so therefore his primary intent over here must be for firewood and not for the clearing of the property. V'amar Shmo, Haiman de Atkil Tikla. One who is Atkil Tikla, via the Aramaic, it's not clear which is the letter that was exchanged, meaning that the Aramaic words many times exchange a letter for the Hebrew word. So you could be Shakal Shikla. Could be that he is weighing something, and I'll explain that in a second. Or it could be from the verb sokel. Sokel in Hebrew, interesting enough, is to stone. But sokel also means to de-stone a property. It means to take all the stones off a property. And so the Rishbam brings that interpretation that it's a case where he's clearing out the stones so that they don't block the ability of the plow to go through. Basically, he's clearing away michsholim. He's clearing away obstacles on the field. So that might be, again, the verb here could be from sokel, which means to de-stone the property, from the word michshol, which means an obstacle, and he's removing obstacles from the property, or from l'shakel. Either way, adaita da'aro, if he's clearing the area or taking these obstacles out of the way in order to facilitate the ability to use the land, koni, then there's a kinyan because he's doing something, engaging in the property in a positive manner, improving the property, and that's his intent. Adaita da'aro, then if he's doing this in order to make a a goren, to set up a threshing area, lo kani, he's not kune. Heichidomi. How do I know whether he's doing it to clear the field so that he can plow it and it'll be easy to plow, whether he's doing it just to create a space in which he can thresh on the field? Shakal mulya, vishoda binatza. If he takes the mulya, is from the word malay, means the tell, those little high spots on the field, the areas where the field goes up, vishoda binatza, and he takes them and he deposits that which he moves into the ditches or depressions in the field. So in essence, what he's doing is leveling out the field. That goes back to what I said before, that the possibility over here of the meaning of the atkil tikla is the shakal shikla, that he is weighing something. When you weigh something, you try to get it to be even or on a flat surface. So here too, he's trying to even out the surface. Adayda da'ara, then he's doing it with the intent of improving the land, and it would be a kinyan. Mulya b'mulya, binatza binatza. On the other hand, if he takes the places that are higher up, the places where the land climbs, and he dumps them next to it. So the way that the Rashbam describes it, and the Rabbeinu Gershom gives the identical explanation, he's saying here where he's taking these areas that are raised, he is digging them up and then depositing the earth around it. So what he's doing is he's flattening out that area. He's reducing the incline in that area, but he's not completely smoothing out the land. And the same thing with the natza benatza. If he has a ditch or a depression in the land, he's not going to get dirt from somewhere else and fill it, but rather he is taking the sides or the edges and pushing them in to the middle. So he's going to make it a less of a decline or less of an issue in terms of the depression in the land, but he's not completely smoothing out the land. Then adaita de beidari. Then he's definitely focused on making it into a threshing floor. So now the Rashbam explains the difference here. He says that when you want to plow the field, you want to work the field, you need the area to be completely flat because you're going to run the plow from end to end on the field. And therefore you want to have a flat field from side to side in order that you can do it efficiently and without having to pull up the plow, without having to go around an area. So you want the whole area flat. On the other hand, when you deal with a threshing area, the threshing area, you need a limited space that is flat. And when you take down the tell, or you take down the mulya, and you deposit it next to it, or you take the ditches and you fill them in, what you're doing is you're creating sections in the field that are flattened out. That doesn't mean that all the sections of the field are the same level. It just means that specific areas in the field, you have flat areas. And because of that, you can make a threshing area in those specific spots, in those locales within the field that have a flat area. And so what the Rashbam says is, the problem with the Goren is that it's only temporary. That you put a threshing floor there, and when you do the threshing, you're going to do that, but you're only using a small part of the field. What you end up doing afterwards is flattening out the field and plowing over the entire field. So the threshing floor that you are creating is only a temporary usage of the field, and it's actually to the detriment of the field. Because what you really want to do is plow it over and plant in it. Now that you made it into a threshing area, you're temporarily using it for something else. But that something else, you're going to have to be soter. You're going to have to undo. So if you put something up that's going to have to be undone because it's not the primary usage of the field, that's not classified as an improvement of the karka. So given that, you will not be considered improving the karka, and you will not get an acquisition of the karka if you create the threshing floor. The other hand, if you flatten it out to the point where you can plow from end to end and you can utilize the whole field, there you will get an acquisition of the field. So the Rashbam says, well, based on my logic, if you make this into a permanent threshing area, then you would be able to acquire the field. Because then you're using this in a permanent fashion, improving it to a point where it can be utilized for this specific reason or purpose. That's what he says here, that if you have a Goren Kavua, that you would succeed at acquiring the property. It's only because it is a temporary Goren that we do not allow you to acquire the field through that usage. This is all based on two things, the Girsa and our Gemara, and the explanation of the Rashbam for why that is, that there is a distinction. The Bach over here, the Balei Tosfot, Rabbeinu Gershom, all point to a Gemara in Moed Katan. In Moed Katan, there the Gemara is also discussing improvements in the land. There in the context of, whether it's Chol HaMoed, but really in Shemitah, which is, if you're doing something to the land, it's the opposite of what we want here. Here we want you to improve the land because that's how you acquire the property. If you're not improving the land, then you don't acquire the property. In the Gemara Moed Katan, we want to know just the opposite. If you're improving the land, then you're violating Shemitah. If you're not improving the land, then it's permitted to do on Shemitah. You can do things on the land on Shemitah as long as you're not doing it for the purpose of planting. So in our case here, if you were doing it to make a threshing floor area, that would be fine in Shemitah because you're not working the land. If you were smoothing out the property in order to plow the property, it obviously would be problematic during the Shemitah. So that's the distinction that's been drawn in Moed Katan. The thing is that in Moed Katan, there is possibly, if you look at the Balei Tosafot, and Daf Yud Amud Bet there, the Balei Tosafot seem to have the girsa be reversed, and he discusses over here what the problem is, and the solutions that come up. You can see it in the Rabbeinu Gershom as well, which is that the Rabbeinu Gershom, after describing what it is, Mulya Bamulya Natsa Benatsa, he says, Hainu Adaita Dara. He says that it means that you're doing it for the purpose of the land. So the Rabbeinu Gershom says that when you do the tall parts or the high parts of the field and you just deposit it next to it, and you take the ditches and you just fill them in a little bit, that is gets you a kinyan on the karka. If you smooth the whole area out, then you don't get a kinyan on the karka. It's the exact opposite of what the Rashbam says. The reason that they're leaning in that way is because of the question of the Balei Tosafot. Hiksha, Rabbeinu Yosef do Orleans. So Rabbeinu Yosef, one of the Balei Tosafot that came from Orleans, the original Orleans, not the new Orleans. Machma, tzarech karka shevel acharisha yoter mili disha. Sounds from our Gemara, and the way that Rashbam is explaining it, that you need a smoother surface or a flatter surface to plow than you do to thresh. Va'anan sade. He says, we harvest our fields all the time. We work in the fields. The ladisha tzarech haber yoter shevel v'chala. You need a surface that is much flatter and smoother for threshing than you do for planting or running a plow. A plow has a certain give to it. You can move up and down a little bit. Threshing, you need to be on an absolutely flat surface. Otherwise, it's very hard to work with the materials are there to get the animals to work or whoever's working in the threshing area. You need it to be absolutely flat. So he says, we see, or evidence that we have, is that it's just the opposite of what the Gemara is suggesting over here. So now, the solution to the problem is, Vayami Faresh, so he changes the definition of the Beidari. The Beidari, we explained till now, was a threshing area. He says, no, the word Dari is like the word deer. Deer is a corral, a pen for animals. And that's what it is. Ramesh, the Beidari, the Hocho, Ainu Lamid Sham Behemot. He's setting up an area to put animals in, to pen them in, for to have them live there or stay there. So the question of setting up the land for something, in the case where you set it up to plow, which is that you're smoothing the whole area out, that's problematic. If you're just smoothing out sections of it, then you're putting your animals, it's for a pen or corral, that's not a violation in Shemitah. And again, in our Gemara, it would be just the opposite, which is that when you do it for the whole land, you're improving the land, you'll get a kinyan. When you're doing it to put a pen or a corral in there, that's not the primary usage of the property, and therefore you will not get a kinyan. But by that, he avoids the problem of having to compare or contrast threshing to plowing as to which needs a smoother surface. Because over here, it's clear that for a pen for animals, you need just smaller areas. You don't need the whole field smoothed out for that. So that's his solution. But the Rabbeinu Tam is Shivlo. Rabbeinu Tam says, no. Shema yu dashim b'morigim. That their process of threshing was different than our process of threshing. Our process of threshing requires a much flatter area because of the way that we thresh, of stomping on the grains or the animals walking on the grains. However, they did it to thresh in his time, but in the time of the Gemara, they had morigim. Morigim are these plates that had pegs or the equivalent of like cleats or nails that came out of the bottom, and they would have the animal drag it around behind them and somebody would stand on it, and then the animal, by dragging it over the grains with these protrusions from the bottom of this plate or this wood, that would cause the threshing or the separation of the wheat from the chaff to happen because of that. So he says for them, they needed these small areas. They didn't need these huge areas because they were using this mechanism for threshing. We who do it over a larger area and we don't use the morigim, then we need a flatter surface that's much wider. And so that's how the Rabbeinu Tam deals with it. But you should know that it's not clear here which way the Gemara is going. Based on the Rashbam, he thinks that the smoothing of the field entirely is for Harisha, and for small areas is for threshing. The Rabbeinu Tam defends that position, even though today we see that it's different. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot bring, and this is what they say in Moed Katan as well, which is that the deer here is not threshing, but rather a deer behemoth, which is a corral or a pen. And he solves the problem that way of the differentiation. Although again, the Balei Tosafot there possibly suggests, and the Bach mentions over here, ita leheja ipcha, that it's just the opposite. That the Gemara Moed Katani, you can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershom, flips the positions and says if you're flattening the whole field out, that's for threshing. If you're flattening out sections of the field, you're just making it so the inclines and declines aren't as steep, that's for the plowing of the field, and that would be problematic in the Shemitah or be beneficial over here in terms of the acquisition of the property. Ramar Shmuel, Haiman de Potach Mayo Be'aro, person who opens up a waterway into the field, Adaited Aro Koni. He does it based on the land itself, he's Kone. Adaited de Kavre, if he did it for the fish, Lo Koni. He's not able to acquire it. So why is he bringing this waterway through his property? To bring the waterway into his property in order to irrigate the field, then obviously that's an improvement in the field, then he'll be Kone. Is he bringing the waterway through because then the fish will go through and he can pick out fish, he can fish on the property, he can take fish from the property. So Echidami. So again, here the Gemara says, how do we know what his primary intent is? It could be that both happen. That when he brings the water in to irrigate the field, he also gets fish. Or when he's fishing, he also gets the water. How do you know what his primary intent is? Patach trade bavei. If he opens up two ways into the field, meaning it's chad mayo, one to bring the water in, v'chad mepik, another one to take the water out, adai de gabre. He's clearly doing that for the fish, because he doesn't want to keep the water in the field. He's allowing the water to come in and then leave the field. It must be that he wants the flow of water that's bringing the fish, and therefore his primary intent is for the fish. Chad bava, if he only has one entrance way, adai de ara. If he's just bringing the water in, but not letting it out, then it's clear that he wants to irrigate the field, or he's using the water for the field, because he's pooling water in order to water the field, or he's allowing the water to flow through the field, but not exit the field, and therefore his primary intent there is to irrigate the field. There was this woman who took benefit from a palm tree on the property of a ger, so she clearly thinks she's going to acquire the property, but she did a bit through Tafshicha. If you remember, that was the second case we brought, the last case that we brought yesterday, Pashach is to prune. She was pruning the tree, but obviously she was pruning the tree not in a manner that was beneficial to the tree, but rather in a manner that was to feed her animals. She was picking it off one side of the tree. She wasn't picking it off evenly from the tree. She wasn't doing something that would be in the normal process of pruning. So we know that that does not accomplish a chazakah or an acquisition on her behalf. The question of whether she continued to do this over many years, or whether the first time she came into the property, she did this, and then in the subsequent times that she worked the property, and whatever she did on the property, she thought she already owned it. So her subsequent actions weren't chazakot, because she didn't think she needed to acquire. She thought she acquired it already. Tlesar Shanim. She did this for 13 years. Atahu. This individual comes along. Rafik Tute Purta. He goes under the palm tree, and he does a little hoeing, little turning over of the earth under the palm tree, which we know accomplishes a chazakah, because it's the equivalent of charisha, plowing, in the field. Ata the kame de Levi, so they came before Levi to adjudicate who is the true owner of this property. Vamri la kame de mar ukva, some say it was brought before mar ukva, ukme biyode. He gave the property to the man that did the hoeing, or the little turning over the earth, after 13 years that this woman was taking something off the property. Atai katsavcha kamei. She comes screaming, what are you doing? I've been using this property for 13 years. Why are you giving it to him? Amala, my avidach. What can I do for you? You didn't take possession of the property like normal people take possession of a property. You need to do something that improves the property. You need to engage in the property in a way that establishes a chazakah. You didn't do that. You ended up doing it in a manner that was not beneficial to the property, but simply benefiting from picking the fruits of the property. Picking the fruits of the property does not establish a chazakah, and therefore you never took ownership. It was as if you were taking it from Hefker. Since you're taking the fruits from Hefker, you didn't establish ownership. When he came along and did some work in the field, he now took that which was Hefker and made it into his. This case law is corroborating or following that position of Shmuel before, that how you engage with the land matters. If you're engaging with the land in a manner that is to improve the land, then you can acquire it. If you're doing it in a manner that simply gives you benefit from the field, but does not improve the field, then you will not get an acquisition of the property, and that will leave it open to others coming along and taking possession of the property in your stead. Amarav, Adzar Tzura B'Nechzei Ager Kana. Someone who draws pictures or designs on the property of a ger is koneh. So now this is a little difficult. All the Rishonim, the Rishbam here points it out right away, is that the Gemara yesterday already spoke about that. And we spoke about if you draw something in the house of the ger, in the paltarin of the ger, then if it's an amah by an amah, and it's opposite the doorway, then you'll get an acquisition because you've improved the house in a significant manner. So what's interesting about this is that we don't have any qualification of size or placement. So why is Rav over here all of a sudden saying that, oh, you just draw a little bit and everything's great and you've acquired the property? Yet before, when we made a similar statement, Amar Abdimi Bar Yosef Amar Balazar, Amotze Paltri Menichse Ger, Vesabem Siud, Vachad, Okiur Achad, Kanan. You do a little plastering or you do a little drawing, then you acquire it. And then we had that qualification of Amah Bayaman Keneged HaPetach. So the Rishbam explains it's the difference in the drawing or the painting that is being done here. In the case of Rav, we're talking about a Tzurat Chayal Of. He's drawing animals, pictures, or designs of something that is in of itself significant because it takes a lot of talent, there's more intricacy involved, and more noticeable. On the other hand, the Tzurot that we're talking about on the previous Amud, we're a case what he calls here, Masei Tzatzuim Uprachim. It's nice designs and flowers. So there it was just an enhancement. I mean, it's a nice decorative piece here. Versus what's being drawn over here is a significant piece. In and of itself, it is something that is artistic in nature, but to the point where you would take a look at it because it was significant. So that's why he says there's no qualification over here of an amah by an amah or keneged hapetach. This type of drawing would be significant no matter where you do it on the property. The other hand, when you're talking about little designs and you're talking about flowers, then where you place it matters because that would only be noticeable or significant if it's in a location and of a size that would catch people's attention. Now, Derav, how do we know that Derav thinks this? Not because he stated something, but rather of an action that he took. Derav elo kani leginta de Bei Rav. Rav only acquired the garden that was adjacent to the Beit Midrash on behalf of the Beit Midrash, ele betzurta, through a drawing. In essence, what happened was there was a property owned by a ger that was adjacent to the Beit Midrash of Rav. The ger passed away, and Rav wanted to take possession of it on behalf of the Beit Midrash. So he did that by drawing a tzurah. So that's how the Gemara from there concluded that if you draw something, you could take possession. What you have to say over here is that it was a gina, or an area that was encircled by a wall of some sort. Because otherwise, what is there? Drawing of pictures is done usually in a house or on some sort of wall. If you just have a fence around the property, or you just have stones, there are no fence around the property, what exactly are you drawing in the garden? So it must be a situation in which there were significant walls around this property, and then he drew whatever he drew on the walls that surrounded the property. And that's why he was able to acquire it. Given that Rav did it in this manner, we would conclude that drawing a tzurah is a sufficient improvement in the property that you would be able to acquire the property by doing such a thing. On the other hand, if you do just some nice designs, decorative, aesthetic additions to the walls where you put up maybe wallpaper, you put up a border on the wall, those are decorative in nature. There it has to be more significant or noticeable because otherwise it's not a significant improvement in and of itself. And so to gain its significance, location and size will matter. Right, so now, this is the end of that series of Memrot by Shmuel. And here, that's where the Rishbam makes his comment that all these things that we mentioned apply not only to Nechse Ager, but apply to any type of transaction. Again, those are argue on him. Now, Itmar, when we're moving back to Nechse Ager, here it's clear that what we're discussing over here is Nechse Ager and taking possession of Nechse Ager. Itmar, Sadeh Misuemet B'mitzareah. A property that is clearly defined on its borders. So it's demarcated, it's obvious where the property lies, and what is the extent of the property. Amravuna Marav, Kevin Shikishba Makush Echad, as long as he did one hoeing on the property, or he hit one hit on the property, Kanakula, he's able to acquire the whole thing. Because it's clearly defined, the area, and he does work on the property, then through that action on a defined property, that small action will acquire for him the whole tract that is demarcated over here. Shmuel Amar, lo kana el makom makusho bilvad. He only acquires the exact area where he's doing the hoeing or he's doing the hitting of the karka, no more than that. So just here, you have a machlok between Rav and Shmuel as to whether when you have nixei ager, when you do a simple hitting of the property, hoeing of the property, which in of itself is an action that will acquire for you, how far is the extent of the acquisition? Rav says, as long as the property is clearly demarcated, then it includes everything that's there. Shmuel says, you get no more than what you did. Now, in a transaction, that would not be the case. That's either because the money that you're paying would indicate or connect between the different properties, or the property itself, it would define the size of the property. And so therefore, when you do the action, it's clearly bounded by the money that already was paid, or the fact that you have another party that's granting you the kinyan. The problem by Nechse Ager is, we have no granting party, and there's no consideration being given. So there's very hard to define what you are acquiring. And that's why there's a machloket here between Rav and Shmuel, that Rav believes you can acquire the extent or the full extent of the property, but Shmuel believes that you cannot acquire the full extent of the property. The question that you're asking is, according to Shmuel, you're putting a very heavy burden on a person who wants to acquire the property of a ger, which is now he's going to have to do something that incorporates the entire property. So now, if you're going to have to hoe or plow the entire field, that seems extensive to take possession of the property. In addition, when it comes to the Mishnah said, "Nal gadar paratz koshu," that any amount would suffice. So what happened to that? And that was clearly speaking about nechse ager as well. So the answer to that question is that when you're nal gadar paratz, the action that you take affects the entire property. If you put up a fence, or complete the fence around the entire property, you breach the fence around the property, you lock up the fence, or you put up a lock onto the fence around the property, your action impacts the entire property. So there you can have a koshu action that is successful at acquiring the whole property. Problem here is that the makosh, the action that you chose, really is specifically beneficial to the location in which you are doing it. It doesn't have implications for the remainder of the field. And so Shmuel says, in order to acquire nechse ager, and again, it's solely by nechse ager, the way that you have to do it is you do an action that is impactful to the entire property. A small action could have that effect, as long as that action involves, like the fence or the lock or something that surrounds the property, because then it's clear that you're affecting the whole property. But if you take action in the property, then you're going to have a harder time saying that you're taking control of the whole property if you don't do something that affects the entirety of the property or do it all over the property. But again, this distinction for Shmuel is only in Nechse Ager. He would agree that in a regular transaction that you would be able to acquire it in this manner. So now, what about the case She'ena Mistyum Et Mitzareah? So over here, now you have an even bigger problem, which is that not only are you trying to acquire something from someone who doesn't exist anymore, it's hefker in a sense, plus there's no consideration. The last part is that there's no defined borders. The field is not clearly demarcated. So now, how do you acquire, or how do you define what you are acquiring? So here is a machloket in the Rishonim as to how to read the next line of the Gemara. We'll read it like the Rashbam first, even though he's in the minority, and then we'll read like the Balei Tosafot. Ad kama, how much do you have to do? Amra papa kid azel taira de shori v'adar. It is the plowing of an ox, of a furrow, and then its return. The way that the Rashbam learns it is, that's how you take possession of the area. You run the furrow all the way from one end of the property to the other end of the property, and then you return and you come back. That defines the tract of property. Obviously, the Rashbam does run into a problem because you only defined one side, which is the length, but you still don't have the width, or if you define the width, you haven't defined the length. He says that comes mamela. That's how the Rashbam learns it. But obviously, that's an issue with the position of the Rashbam. That's number one. Number two, that the Balei Tosafot say two things. One is, why do you have to go back? Why isn't it enough to drive the furrow one way? Why do you have to return on the furrow? Number three is, the language of the Gemara doesn't seem to support it. And therefore, the Balei Tosafot explain, and this is the way most Rishonim explain it, is that the question here is not about how do you acquire a field without borders, but rather, how much do you acquire in a field without borders when you do makosh echad? When you do one hit to the ground, or one hoeing of the ground, when you have defined borders, we said you get the whole field. That's what Rav said before. Within the position of Rav, the Gemara wants to know now, if you do one hit on a field that has no non-defined borders, what do you get? The answer is, tell him, you get a furrow. You get the amount of plowing one way and back. I mean, that's the natural way to plow a field. That what we're speaking about here, it's actually a Rashi in Chumash, says something similar with regards to Od Kivrata Aretz Efrata. When Yaakov buries Rachel, he says that they were within striking range of Efrat. Od Kivrat Aris, Rashi says, is the normal length of a plow, which is the normal length of a field. He says it means a plowed field, as the normal length that people plow in a single direction and field. And he says there was a known amount. That's what Rashi says there. And Bali Tosfot say the same thing now. That there was a standard length of furrow that people plowed on the field. So if you do a makosh echad, you get that standard length of the field. That's what you acquired. Because you took possession, you did something in the field. No defined borders. We'll define it for you. The definition is how much a person would plow in a single plowing. That length you would get of the field. That's what you would acquire. So that's how they explain it, but it's the exact opposite of the Rashbam. It has two implications. Number one is, it's not about how you acquire undefined property. You can't acquire undefined property unless you define it. That's what the Baal HaTosafot is saying. The Rashbam says, no, there's an amount that you do that you would acquire it. Number two is, the way the Baal HaTosafot is explaining it, this part of the Gemara is inside of Rav. Which means that, according to Shmuel, this wouldn't be irrelevant. Because according to Shmuel, you can't even acquire when the property is defined. Inside of Rav, where you have defined property you would acquire, what do you acquire in an undefined property? That means that the Gemara is following Rav and not Shmuel. That has implications in terms of the Psak Halacha, which is that here you have a Machloket Rav and Shmuel. Generally, the Psak Halacha would be Kishmuel, because Halacha Kishmuel B'dine. Halacha is Kirab B'Sure. So here, this is Dine, this is Dine Mamonot, the Halacha should be like Shmuel. Nevertheless, we pass in like Rav over here. One, because the Gemara, according to the Baal HaTosafot and many Rishonim, is now discussing within Rav. And so that would give you a reason to believe that the law is like Rav. Plus, Rav Nachman later on is going to paskin like Rav. Given that you have both of those pieces of information, then we're going to paskin like Rav. Rashbam says it over here. Bach plukta yuchata k'rav, dar Rav Nachman avad uvda k'vatei d'rav. Because later on, Rav Nachman is going to paskin like Rav. And for the Baal HaTosafot, you have the additional aspect, which is the Gemara here is arguing within Rav. Or the Gemara is discussing within the position of Rav. If that's the case, it's clear that the Gemara thought that Rav's position was the one that we would pass them like, and therefore they want to figure out more about that or plumb the depths of that position when there's a case where you don't have defined borders. All right. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. So Rav Yehuda has the name of Shmuel. Nichsei Oved Kochavim Harehen Kamidbar. Possessions of an Oved Kochavim of the din of Amidbar. Kol Machzik Behem Zachaben. Anyone who takes possession of them is Zocheh, he merits to be the owner of that property. Now, that's not a statement about the property of an Oved Kochavim in general. This isn't that you can walk over to any Oved Kochavim's property and say, it's mine, I'm taking it from you, too bad. That's not what Shmuel is speaking about. But rather, it's speaking about a transaction. A transaction in which a Jew is purchasing property from a non-Jew. In that case, as soon as the Jew pays the money, the consideration for the property then is released from the Oved Kochavim. And that's what it says here. My time, Oved Kochavim, Michimato Zuzi de Yode, once the money reaches him, istalikle, he relinquishes his control over the property. Yisrael Okani, the Jew, does not acquire it, Adamati Shkar de Yode, until the Shkar reaches his hand. In this case, you have to look at what's the normal construction of a transaction. And that is, as all the Rishonim point out over here, it must be that this is a place, or this is a locale where Jews, when they transact with each other, they require a shtar to be drawn up. It's not enough that the money changes hands, but you need a shtar to finalize the transaction. So now you have an unevenness in the transaction, which is that for the Oved Kochavim, the transaction will be completed by Kesef. Money will be the mechanism for the Kinyan here. Right. So as soon as he receives the money, he relinquishes control over the property. For the Yisrael, whereby money is not sufficient, he needs a shtar to acquire the property, then until the shtar is there, he does not acquire the property. So now you have a gap between the relinquishment of the control of the Oved Kochavim and the acquisition of the Yisrael. That gap leaves the property as hefker in between. And that's what Shmuel is discussing. That means that's a dangerous time when someone can jump in and take possession of the property because of the relinquishment of control by the Oved Kochavim, but to yet come into the possession of the Yisrael. The question is, why? Why is it that the Oved Kochavim only relinquishes control when there is a money that comes into his possession and the Jew is waiting for the shtar? So the Rashbam over here claims, and it's similar to a position that was brought by the Baal HaTosafot and Rashi in the Maran Kiddushin, is that the primary acquisition or the primary type of kinyan for an Oved Kochavim is Kesef. Kesef is the mechanism or the vehicle for acquisition of an Oved Kochavim, and thereby all of his transactions will be governed by Kesef. So we understand why for the Ovid Kochavim, Kesef is the mechanism for Kinyan or for relinquishment of control, because that's their primary vehicle for acquisition. On the other hand, for the Jew, he can acquire property either through Kesef or he can acquire it through Shtar. We know that in locations where they used Kesef but still waited for the Shtar, he doesn't acquire it until the Shtar is there. But why not in this situation just say that he doesn't worry about the Shtar? He wants the property right away. So as soon as the Kesef goes, he will get the property. So the Rishbam gives one reason, which is that the individual doesn't trust the Oved Kochavim. The Stam Oved Kochavim are anasim, or they are questionable in their transactions or their ownership of the property. And therefore, the Jew does not finalize the transaction or doesn't think it's complete until he gets a Shtar to document the sale. In essence, until he gets a title to the property, he's not going to think that the transaction's done. Even after he's given the money, he doesn't think he's done until he gets the Shtar. So the Rishbam says that's why, even though the Jew technically could have acquired it through Kesef, he doesn't do this because he has in mind that he wants the Shtar, and therefore he's waiting for the Shtar for the transaction to be finalized. The Baalei HaTosafot suggests something different, which is that the Jew acquires the property in the way that he thinks he acquires it in every other transaction. He's not necessarily so sophisticated to understand there might be a difference between a Goy and a Jew. He just knows whenever he transacts with Israel, he has to wait for the Shtar to be finalized. So when he does this transaction, he looks at the transaction like he looks at any other transaction that he's involved in, and he says, the Shtar is what finalizes it, so he waits for the Shtar. It's an outgrowth of his normal transactions that he engages with the other his fellow Jews. He says that's the way it works there, he just applies it over here. And that's his mindset when he comes here. But Eino Chanami, if one stipulates that either through the Kesef I'll acquire it, or through the Shtar, meaning he makes it or articulates it clearly that he can acquire it through the Kesef, then he might be able to overcome the problem. According to the Baalei HaTosafot, he could overcome the problem because it's just a failure of mindset over here. So if he has in mind to acquire it properly, then he could get it through the Kesef and he could close this whole loophole down. The other hand, for the Rashbam, who believes that this is fundamental to the transaction, that he doesn't think or he doesn't feel the transaction is done until he gets title, then even if he says, I want to acquire it through the Kesef, we say, B'tela dato etzo kol adam. People don't acquire that way. People won't take possession in this manner because they're scared of losing the property or having it confiscated. So they want title and they won't accept the transaction's done until the title passes. And so this gap will still be there even if he articulates otherwise. Now, the premise for this acquisition being through Kesef and the Goy, according to the Rashbam, is because that's his primary form of Kinyan. The Rabbeinu Tam here argues, as he does in the Gemara in Kiddushin, and he says that that's a misunderstanding of the Gemara in Kiddushin based on the acquisition of Eved Ivri. He says it's only true by an Eved Ivri that Kesef is the only mechanism for a non-Jew to acquire an Eved Ivri. But in other transactions, the primary vehicle for acquisition is a kinyan mishicha, is the way that a goy takes possession. So then why in our case over here do we assume that when the kesef comes into his possession that he relinquishes control? So that's what the Baalei HaTosafot explained, because what are the alternatives? The alternatives are a kinyan shtar versus a kinyan kesef. We know that a goy has a kinyan kesef. We have that by Ephron and Abraham, that you can trade property through kesef and create an acquisition. We also know that a kinyan mishicha works by a goy. Over here, you want to also add in kinyan shtar, because that for a Jew will be the finalized product. Kinyan shtar in the Gemara Kiddushin, we only learn out from the psukim in Yirmiyahu that tell us sefer makneh, that through a sefer, through a shtar, you can acquire the property. That's a limud, that's a chiddush, that you can acquire property through a shtar. The goy doesn't have that chiddush. So the goy is only left with options of mishicha or kesef for acquisition. Well, mishicha is obviously not valid or useful by property. The only thing he's left with is kesef. So it's not because his primary mechanism of acquisition is kesef that it works over here. It's simply that he has no alternative. It's the only way that he can do it, and shtar is not relevant to him. Since shtar is not relevant to him, when he gets the kesef, he's done, and therefore he's mistalek his ownership. So those are two different approaches, the approach of the Baalei HaTosafot, the approach of the Rashbam, as to why kesef relinquishes control, and as to why also the Jew is acquiring it once a shtar to be in place, only acquires it once there's a shtar in place. Now, to your question, why can't he make sure that the shtar is there first and then give the kesef afterwards? There are Rishonim who believe that that would not work, because the shtar is only valid once the kesef is exchanged. He can't acquire from the goy with a shtar, because a shtar is not a mechanism for acquisition from a goy. So the only way he acquires it is through the kesef. So it might be that the shtar is only valid or useful to him once the kesef is done, once the transaction happened. To write the shtar before the transaction would not work, necessarily would not be valid. And so therefore there are those that believe that even if he reversed it, it wouldn't work over here because the shtar is meaningless until the kesef exchanges hands. And so therefore he has to have the purchase done before he can write the shtar to finalize the transaction. All right, so now that's the position of Shmuel. Hilkach, he says, so since the goy relinquishes control, and the Jew only takes possession once he gets the shtar, Hilkach, harien kemidbar. Therefore, in that interim stage, they are hefker, kol mazik bem, zachach bem. And anybody who takes possession of them is successful at taking possession of them. Now, what do you think of a guy who does that? An individual goes ahead and runs in, sticks his head in the middle of the transaction, takes the property. What do you think of someone like that? Is that person doing something which is permitted and there's no problem with it? And you say, look, he took advantage of a loophole. Good for him. Or do we say that this person is not acting in a proper manner? We have questions about his integrity or whether he should be doing something like this. Is it asita yashar batol? So here the Rashbam takes a position on this. He says, he's kana utam kiloim nikseya ger shemet. V'yesh mifashim dema'ot mil yachzir lelokeach harishon. There are those that say that you have to refund the money to the purchaser. This second guy who steps into the transaction and takes the property for free, he will have to pay back the for Jew who paid the goy for the original property. It says, Vali ein nira klau. So I don't think that's right at all. I think that's completely incorrect. Mi nira beinai, that I think, the high sheni rasha mikre. He's called a rasha. The person who does this is doing something underhanded. He's doing something that we would not endorse, and he's called a Rasha, because he's no different than Ani HaMeapech Becharura. An Ani who's looking at something, he's going to take something, and then you go in and snatch it before he takes it. There, the Gemara in Kiddushin says, Ani HaMeapech Becharura, Nikra Rasha, called a Rasha. And over here, you are no different. Ba'acher v'nadla demikra Rasha hu acher. And since this acher is called a rasha when he snatches something away from the ani that was working with it, so to over here, when you snatch this property away from this other Jew, you are called a rasha. So the Rashbam takes a position on two points. Number one is, somebody who does this, it's not innocuous. The person who does this is a rasha. But, despite the fact that he's a rasha, he does not have an obligation to compensate that Jew for it. And the Rashbam says over here, he will have to go back to the goy to try to get his money refunded. First Jew who lost the property, he can go back to the goy and say, recourse, the property was taken now, I want my money back. The Balei HaTosafot speak about that and then limit the capability of you to do that. And they say that even though you have the ability to go back to the goy and try to make your claim for the property, demand his money back because the property was taken from him, and even though he knows that the goy is then going to go back and take the property from the other Jew or do something to the other Jew, it's fine because the individual took that property, didn't pay for it, didn't do anything for it, and you're only going to the goy. You're an indirect cause of that confiscation of the property. But if he's going to go and then demand payment from that individual, here the Balei HaTosafot say that you may not do that. It's by the fraud of Motav. And take money from him, that's considered to be a moser, and therefore you can't do it. Meaning if the second Jew who took possession of the property is willing to compensate you for the property that he took, then you have no right to go back to the goy at this point to have him take the karka and then return it to you, because you've gotten full remuneration for that which you lost. And in terms of zchuyot, this individual came in and took possession of it, has a right to take the property. And he's fully compensated you for your loss, so you have no reason to go back to the goy. If you go back to the goy now, and he's going to interfere with the ownership of this Jew, after he's compensated you for it, that's considered to be a moser, and would be improper. So that's the view of the Rashbam, and the expansion of the Balei HaTosafot on that, to explain it. Right, so now, what the Rashbam raises over here, is an issue of Ani HaMeapech Becharura. So I'm just going to take 2 minutes here to explain Ani HaMeapech Becharura, because of the value in understanding it in this context, as well as another Gemara we saw in Bava Batra and the Gemara in Kiddushin. That's the last time we discussed it. That's where the main sugya is in the Gemara in Kiddushin. The Gemara there speaks about the issue of Ani HaMeapech Becharura on Daf Nun Tet Amud Aleph. We actually saw it back on Bava Batra, Daf Chaf Aleph, with setting up traps with the fishermen next to each other about whether you're allowed to do that. There is a fundamental machlok between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam as to when ani amapech b'charura applies. Rashi over there says that ani amapech b'charura has application beyond just mecher or transactions, but even has application by situations that involve hefker or situations that involve matana. I mean, ani amapech b'charura is a broad din that anybody who is engaged in the acquisition of a certain property and you cut him off, you jump in there and take it away, that's all a problem of ani amapech b'charura, and you are nikra rasha. Doesn't matter if he's trying to pick up an aveda, doesn't matter if he's trying to purchase something or he's getting a gift from someone. If you interfere, that interference is considered to be improper and you will be called a rasha. The Rabbeinu Tam disagrees. The Rabbeinu Tam says that ani amapech b'charura only has application where it's all even, which is that you're going to purchase a property here, and then some other guy comes in and tries to snatch the property away from you. In snatching the property away from you, he's doing two things. One is, he's undermining all the work or effort that you put in. Number two is, he's buying this property when he can buy another piece of property, and he's just taking it away from you, and so therefore he's causing you a loss in a sense, which is that now you, who had negotiated and put all this work in, aren't going to be able to buy this property. When all things are even and he could buy another piece of property, why do this to this person and why bother this person? In the case of hefker, where there's no option besides this, hefker or a naveda, there's only one of those. So if you don't come in and snatch it, if this guy takes it, you're not going to have another opportunity. In that case, there's no issue of ani amapech b'charura. Rabbeinu Tam's big proof to that is in peyah. By peyah, when the ani comes and he throws himself on top of the peyah, he throws his cloak on top of the peyah, we say that we remove him or remove his cloak from the peyah, and we allow the other aniyim to take it. So now, over there, he fails in his acquisition because he wasn't makzik, he didn't take possession of it in the way that normally people do. He forfeited his dalet amot that usually acquire for him, and he's trying to do an acquisition in a manner that doesn't work. We remove him from it. Rabbeinu Tam says, why do we remove him from the property? Why do we remove him from the peyah? These are items by which he was already mehapech. Okay, he didn't acquire them, but he was already engaged in them. Why should we remove him from them? The answer is, these are hefker. And so what the Rabbeinu Tam says, in matters of hefker, you don't have a right, or you know, mehapech doesn't help you out, because everybody has to be on equal footing to fight about it. So now, in the case of the fishermen back on Chaf Aleph, there, the Rabbeinu Tam now runs into a problem. Because over there, the Gemara suggested that when you set up a trap, and you place it by whatever, the hole of the fish, or you put in a dead fish to capture the other fish, someone else comes and impinges on that area, he's considered to be stealing from you, or he's doing the improper thing. For the Rabbeinu Tam, why should that be? It's hefker. Hefker, fish in the sea, or fish are coming, why can't you fish there, just like he can fish there, because it's all hefker. So the Rabbeinu Tam is the problem with his position vis-a-vis our Gemara. The answer the Rabbeinu Tam and the Baal Tosfot gave there was that it's different. First of all, there are a lot of fish in the sea. Why do you have to fish in this particular location? You could fish somewhere else and get the same results. So that's number one. Number two is, the person here has taken an action by which he's almost definitively going to capture the fish. He put in bait, or he put in something that's going to draw the other fish there, and it's almost as if he took possession of it already. Once he takes possession of it, for you to come now and try to snatch it away, or fish it away, or draw those fish away, that's already problematic, even according to the Rabbeinu Tam. So now here you have a fundamental machloket between the Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi, as to when ani amapech b'charura will apply. Does it apply to hefker, or does it not apply to hefker? Rashi thinks it applies across the board. Rabbeinu Tam thinks it only applies to transactions, not to hefker. So now, in our case over here, is ani amapech b'charura relevant? According to the Rashbam, and according to Rashi, it is relevant because we're dealing with hefker. Here's a situation in which he's purchasing the property, but the interim stage results in something being hefker. It's a unique opportunity. It's not going to be around forever. So if he comes in and snatches it, he shouldn't be considered ani amapech b'charura, according to the Rabbeinu Tam. As for Rashi and the Rashbam, he wouldn't be considered ani amapech b'charura. And that's what the Rashbam says over here, that he is nikra rasha. Now, as far as compensation is concerned, the Rashbam over here says, despite the fact that he is ani amapech b'charura, he does not have to compensate. He does not have to pay for it. So now, the Chidushei Ramban, on our daf here, quotes the Rashbam, and he notes the difference between the position of Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam, and he says that Rashi's interpretation is clearly correct, And he favors Rashi's interpretation in the situation. The reason he says that the proof the Rabbeinu Tam brings from Peah is not correct is because all the Aniyim are vying for the Peah. Peah is not that you threw your cloak on it or you jumped on it, therefore it's yours, because there you're impinging on someone else's rights, which is the Aniyim, all are searching for the Peah. They're all going after the Peah. So when you do something, if we were to favor you, then that's at the expense of someone else. And what the Ramban points out is that we don't do Vasita Yashar V'Tov when you're impinging on someone else's rights. That's what we saw with Bar Metzra, Dina de Bar Metzra, that you're allowed to purchase the adjacent property or demand a first right of refusal if it doesn't hurt the seller, if it doesn't hurt the other parties there. But we're not going to do a Yashar V'Tov for you at the expense of someone else where the seller has to sell it for a lower price, or the other party who's buying it has no other alternatives. In those cases, we're not going to call it a Sita Yashar V'Tov. And similarly over here, if there are other people vying for those rights and you try to exercise or overextend your rights, we're going to push you back and say the other people's rights also are meaningful over here, not just your rights. Therefore, he agrees with Rashi's position and disagrees with the Rabbeinu Tam. On the other hand, he says with regards to the Rashbam's position over here, Umiyu, Rav Shmuel Shekotav, Umiyu Rosh HaMikri, Amar Sheinu Chayev Lachzir Damim Lokeach Rishon, says that you don't have to pay the money. He says, "Aval matzati Rabbeinu Haigon did chayav la durei dmei," that you have to give back the money. Venirin hadivarim, and I think he's right. So here, the Ramban believes like Rashi that you are called a rasha over here, even though it's coming from hefker. But he disagrees with the Rashbam, saying that you're only a rasha and you don't have to pay. The Rashbam's proof is that the Gemara in Kiddushin, when it says ani amapek b'chara, over there it says that you're called a Rasha. The implications are you are a Rasha, but not that you have to compensate, not that you have to pay. On the other hand, what the Rabban says is that Rav Haigon says, when Nikra Rasha, you still are obligated to pay. Umiyu, achrayut ala goy, shua mocher below Israel. Even though you have to pay the money, if the property then gets confiscated or taken away, the recourse will not be against the Jew who you paid. Your recourse will be against the ultimate seller who was the goy. And therefore, if you want to exercise your recourse, you're going to have to go back to the goy, not to the Israel. The Israel is selling it to you against his will. He's not selling it to you because he wants you to, but he's selling it because you took possession of it. But that adverse possession that you are taking only allows you the right to purchase it, does not allow you the right to go to get recourse from that individual. The recourse will be against the original seller, the goy. So here you have three different views as to what happens in this case. Either you're not called aniyam apek b'chara at all, not a rashad, that'd be the view of the Rabbeinu Tam, the Balei HaTosafot. On the other hand, you could be called a rashad like Rashi and the Rashbam say, because you're dealing with hefker. But the Rashbam says, despite the fact that you're a rashad, you do not have to compensate. And then you have the Ramban who believes that not only are you a rashad, but you also have to compensate in this case. The way that Dushe Rashbam expresses is that, v'day im mechayvin oto lachzir ma'ot lokeach rishon nikra rashad. Inextricably connected, which is that by definition, when you call the Rasha, that implies that there is compensation that has to happen. The two are connected, and therefore anytime you have a din of Rasha, you also have a din of compensation. If there's no din in compensation, you're not a Rasha, which is that if you're going to force him to pay, then of course he's called a Rasha. He says, Vatema min Rabzal, prize the position of the Rashbam, Shekotav kan shenikra Rasha, that he says you're called a Rasha, even though you don't have to return the money. And the Rashba is surprised by that. He says, how could it be that there's a separation between these two in Yanim? The Shulchan Aruch, when he passes the Halacha, he brings down both opinions. He brings down B'yeshomrim. He brings two B'yeshomrims, one that suggests that by Hefker there is no din of Ani Mapech, and then one that suggests that there is a din of Ani Mapech. And then the Ramah, commenting on that, says that the halacha seems to favor that of the Rabbeinu Tam, that there is no din on any mapech b'charura when it comes to things that are hefker, because he says, svara rishona nira ikar. And he also says that, b'chein, ima koneh davar echad, person is trying to buy something, uvachavirov yucholik noto bizol, that he has now can buy it at a lower price, she'enu motzilik noto ken b'makom acher, he's no ability to buy it at this lower price anywhere else. You have a right to intervene because it is a mitziyah. Meaning that if this is a sale whereby the price is lower than the market price, and it is a mitziyah, Then, according to the Rabbeinu Tam, who says that when it's a one-time find, you have a right to go in there. It's not called Aniyah Min HaPech B'chara. You would be allowed to intervene in this case because you're selling it at a lower price. So that's what we see here again, that selling at a lower price or a discounted price is a reason for you to be allowed to intervene or to try to buy it, because you should have the equal opportunity to take advantage of this sale or this special sale. That's the view of the Rabbeinu Tam. Again, for Rashi, it's going to be problematic, because Rashi says even in matters of Hefker, Mitziah, it would be still a problem. Now what happens, like in the case that Fred was mentioning before, which is that you're bidding on a property, and then you come in and bid a higher price on the property. Here, Rav Moshe points out that is not considered to be a problem, because the seller should not be forced to then sell to the party that he first engaged with. That means anytime a seller engages with a party, and they try to work out a price, and they come to a price, then someone comes and bids a higher price, he's stuck. He can't sell it to the higher price. Well, why should we do that? If the whole point of Asita Yashar Batov, or the fact that Ani Apech Bechara, is to protect the rights of the buyer who's engaged over here, then why are we doing that at the expense of the seller? The seller should have those same rights, which is that he should be able to sell for the highest price possible. So in that case, the Rav Moshe points out that we would favor the rights of the mocher to say that other parties can come in and bid on the property so that the seller maximizes his return or his sale price on the property. And we're not going to then say that, no, you have to only deal with this one party, to his detriment, to the favor of that party that engaged with him first. And so that's why he thinks that you can come in and bid in those cases, and that's not called Ani Amepech Bechara, until there's a kinyan, until there's a finalization of the sale. Now, the Balei HaTosafot mention in Kiddushin about hiring of a teacher. And he says that another teacher, a melamed, can't go into the house of a balabayit and try to displace the current tutor or teacher that is there. That is Ani Amepech Bechara. Here he already has an engaged person that's teaching. You can't go in there and try to displace him, because that is a problem of trying to, whether it's Mesi Gvul, trying to take away someone else's parnasa, but also this Ani Amepech Bechara. So somewhere where this transaction already exists, or there's a relationship that exists, you're trying to undermine that relationship. Now, if the balabayit says he's not happy with him, and he's approaching you, then you have a right to deal with him, because the balabayit has expressed his dissatisfaction with the one that is there. The other way around, if the person is teaching a certain family in town, and another family wants to hire this individual, they have a right to do that, because they can make a claim, like the Rabbeinu Tam, that's what the Balei HaTosafot say, that it's no different than Hefker. This teacher is a great teacher, and my kid will only learn from this teacher. So you can say this is a unique asset. Since it's a unique asset, he has a right to go in there and bid him away, and try to have him teach his children, even though he's going to have to leave the other person who he's teaching right now. That isn't a problem of Ani Amepech Bechara, because it's considered to be a unique asset. And since it's a unique asset, you can bid on it. The asset, just like anybody can bid on the asset, because everybody has, in a sense, equal zechuyot to go after that property when it's a unique asset, according to the Rabbeinu Tam. So that would be the way the Balei HaTosafot will view it. Why this is so important is because somebody sent a question to Rav Moshe Feinstein asking about shiduchim. What happens if two individuals are dating, and they've been dating seriously, and now someone else wants to come in and break up the shidduch and take the girl? Are you allowed to do that? Is that considered to be Ani Hamapech Becharara? That's why Rav Moshe writes a tshuva, beautiful tshuva, found in Ibn Ezer, Aleph, Siman, Tzadi Aleph. He also has another tshuva that has business dealings as well. But this tshuva is very interesting, and he goes through the different shitot, the different ideas, and he says, of course, there'll be a difference between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam over here as to what you think. And then he goes on to explain that there's, in addition to there being a problem possibly of Ani Amepech Bechara, there's also a cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, not to steal away a shidduch. So what Rabbi Moshe Feinstein speaks about is, where is that threshold? He says that he thinks there is a threshold beyond which the shidduch is finalized, to the point where if you steal away the woman at that point, you'd be subject to the cherem, the Rabbeinu Gershom. And so he says, before that point in time, he thinks that that is not classified as Ani Amepech Bechara, because, first of all, the woman is a unique asset. Since she's a unique asset, then everybody has a right to vie for that unique asset. You can't find a replacement woman, even though you can find another shidduch, but it may not be this woman. And therefore, you have a right to vie for that. Number two is, maybe even according to Rashi, says that when you're dealing with items, even of Hefker, there's still any of Pech B'chara, this is similar to the case where you have a property where you have multiple bidders. And we said before that if the first person is bidding, you can come and raise it, the bid, and try to buy away the property, because that's to the benefit of the seller. And we're not going to compromise the seller's rights just to help the person who was there first. He says the same thing by the shidduch. We're not going to compromise the woman's rights because this guy was the first guy who approached her with the shidduch, and he's working with her in order to become engaged, or he is building a relationship with her. So now what are we going to say? The woman has to suffer because he was the first one, and she can't have the opportunity to see other shidduchim? That would be unfair to the woman. So even according to Rashi, it may not be aniyam epech b'charara, because we're not going to enforce the rights of the person who was the first one to come into the shidduch at the expense of the woman. She's going to lose out now. Maybe there's a better shidduch. Maybe there's a better opportunity for her. That's the equivalent of someone bidding higher on the field where the benefit of the mocher supersedes us locking it in of aniyam epech b'charara. Same thing over here. The benefit of the woman should supersede the person who was there first with the shidduch. Rav Moshe goes through there in the tshuva, it's a longer tshuva, about where exactly that threshold is. Is it when they get engaged? Is it only when they do the tanaim? What happens, like today, where we only do the tanaim at the wedding itself? Where is that point of no return? Because he says, look, they just laid out all this money for a wedding. It's clear that they're getting married, even though the tanaim are not signed. Everybody's paid money. They paid for a whole wedding. There's no question they're getting married. So he speaks about, or tries to determine where the threshold is, where you move from being an open competitive market to a point where it will become subject to the cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom. But he does say that he doesn't think shidduchim are subject to this din of aniyam epech b'chara, certainly for the Rabbeinu Tam not, because you have a unique asset, but maybe even for Rashi, because it would come at the expense of the woman or at the expense of the mocher, and even there Rashi agrees that you don't have an enforcement of aniyam epech b'chara. All right, just a little sidebar about this issue, because of the Rashbam, who takes a mixed approach here to aniyam epech b'chara, but has implications on our Gemara when somebody behaves in this manner. How do we look at this type of behavior? Right now, Amalei Abaye the Rav Yosef. So Abaye questions Rav Yosef. Abaye is the Talmid of Rav Yosef, and he's asking Rav Yosef, "Mi amar Shmuel hachi?" Did Shmuel really say that what we are suggesting over here, which is that when it comes to nichsei obdei kochavim in this type of transaction, there is this loophole by which, in the interim stage, it would be hefker and someone else could take possession of it. V'amar Shmuel, dina demalchuta dina. That when it comes to the law of the land, the law of the land governs. And what is the law of the land here? Umalka amar lo likneara elabi grato. You're only allowed to acquire the property through a documentation. Whether that means like a star, like we're speaking about here, or whether that means that you have to actually register it with the government. The reason for registering it with the government is not because of the title issues, but because they want to collect taxes from you. So they want to know who's the owner of the property. So what you see here is that there's a demand, even in these locales, where maybe the Ovei Kochavim, Midina de Torah, doesn't have a requirement of a shtar, but Midina de Malchut as a requirement of a shtar. Given that, then you would require, there would be no interim stage. The whole transaction would only be completed once the shtar goes through, because for both parties, that would be the governing rule, which is the law of the land. So that seems to be a stira in Shmuel's position. Just as a sidebar, since we've done Dina Malchut to Dina in other contexts, I'll just mention it here, because here is the position of the Rashbam, which is the position of most of the Rishonim as to why Dina Machuta Dina works. And that is, he says, Kol misim varnoniot uminagot shel mishpatei melachim. When you deal with all the taxes, and the land taxes, and the practices that deal with the law of the land of the king, shirigilim lanig b'melachutam, that are normally practiced in this area, dinahu. So when we spoke about this, we noted that many of the Rishonim point out that it can't be that it is a punitive law. It can't be a law that is biased in some manner, that it is punishing a particular group or is assigned to a particular individuals, because then it's not the law of the land, but rather it is a discriminatory law. It's not the law of the land. So that you see this from the Rashbam, because he says that Shirigilim Lanig Malchutam. It's a normal law that's been there. Part of, now some of the other Rishonim demand that it be a law on the books for a long time. Can't be just a law that suddenly made up. Many have described it as to be a fair law. It has to be something that meets all these standards in order to be considered a law. Shekol b'nei ha-malchut mikablim aleihem mirtzonam. All the people of the area willingly accept chukei ha-melech u-mishpatav, the law of the land or the laws that the king lays out. V'yokach din gamur here. So what the Rashbam is describing is a social contract. Dina de malchut dina functions, according to the Rashbam, through a social contract, which is that we are all parties to this area. And in our agreement is that anybody who lives in this area is subject to the rules of the king. Since we're subject to the rules of the king, because that's what we agreed to, or that's the social contract between us, therefore everybody abides by these laws, and that's what's the governing principle in Dina Malchut Dina. There is an alternate view that's brought by the Ran and the Darim, which has implications, a chiddush of the Ran over there, which is not widely accepted, which is Dina de Malchut Dina has to do with the king. The king owns all the property. And therefore, if you want to live on the property, there's eminent domain of the king, you got to follow the laws of the king. You don't follow the laws of the king expels you, or he can do whatever he wants to you. You live here, subject to the rules of the king. The chiddush of the Ran is that in Eretz Yisrael, where the king doesn't own the property, where every Jew owns his Dalet Amot, or every Jew has a right of ownership there, that there's no Dina de Malchut Dina. It's a huge chiddush of the Ran that is not widely accepted. It's strange that it's quoted even in the halacha by some people today to justify some actions because it's such a minority view and it's not accepted the halacha. But that is the other view. The other view is that the king owns everything and therefore you're subject to the king. Versus here, the Rashbam's view, which is that it is a social contract. So now the failure to pay taxes and the failure to abide by those laws is a violation of Dina de Malchut Dina, according to the Ran, because the king now has a right to expel you, do whatever he wants to you, or the government, in that case, has a right to expel you. On the other hand, the way that the Rashbam writes it is that there's a social contract between the parties. That social contract obligates all the parties. Now, if you fail to abide by it, then whatever the social contract of the repercussions of that will also, you'll be subject to. Rav Shechter, when he spoke here, mentioned a different view or reason that you might be obligated to pay taxes, not just because of Dina de Malchut Dina, whether it's because the king has eminent domain or government has eminent domain or because of the social contract, but because you are mechuyav. You are actually obligated to your fellow Jews to do this. And he brought examples from the Gemara as well as the Poskim and the Halacha that if you live in a city, that by definition you are a partner to all the public works or anything that happens in the city, and we will obligate you to pay into the public works of this city. And your obligation to pay into the public works of the city is an enforceable right by the other parties that are there. And that is because if you don't pay in for the public works, the burden is going to be heavier on the other parties. And that's what he says here with regards to tax evasion or not following the laws, that if you don't pay in, or if you try to circumvent the laws, then other parties are going to have to bear the burden of your lack of payment or your lack of honesty over here. And so therefore, he thinks you have a right to turn over such a person to the authorities or to compel them to pay their taxes, because if they don't pay their taxes, my taxes are going to go up. And therefore, as partners, as shutafim, as partners in everything that we do, you as a partner can demand of your partner to do his share. And if he doesn't do his share, then you can turn him over to the authorities because in a sense, we all are shutafim, and there are enforceable rights of the partnership. Anyway, that's just a quick overview of Dina Malchut Dina. We've delved into it more deeply in other occasions, but here, because this is the primary location of the Rashbam's position, that of social contract, just wanted to lay it out again and just give a quick overview of Dina de Malchut Dina. So now the Gemara continues, Amale, Ana lo yadana, I don't know these memorot of Shmuel, Ella uvda hava, Bedura dira'uta. There was this case. So he says, I don't know what you're telling me about Shmuel's statement, but rather I know case law in which Shmuel was involved, which is in Bedura dira'uta. Either way, Bedura dira'uta is the name of the place, or the other possibility is Dura dira'uta is from the word dir, which is a living place, dira, and ra'uta is from the word ro'eh. So it was a village of shepherds. So that's the other possibility of what Bedura dira'uta is. It's a village of shepherds, or it's a proper noun. It's a name of a place. Bisrael de Zaman Aram Meobi Kochavim. A Jew bought property from a non-Jew. Va'ad Yisrael Achrina. And then a third party, a Jew, comes in. Rofik Baporta. He did some work on it between the time of the cash exchange and the shtar. Ata the Kamei de Rabbi Yehuda. They came to Rabbi Yehuda to adjudicate the case. Ukmei biyoda desheni. And he gave it to the second party, the party who intervened. He gave him the property. So now, that's a psak halacha, like Shmuel's din. Now the problem is that Rabbi Yosef over here brought a member or a case law that involved Rabbi Yehuda, not Shmuel. And over here he's trying to determine the position of Shmuel. So the Rishbam notes this, but we know this all over Shas, that Rabbi Yehuda first learned by Rav, and after learning by Rav, he moved over to Shmuel, and he's a Talmud Muvak of Shmuel. And so what Rabbi Yosef's point is that if Rabbi Yehuda passed him like this, in all likelihood he got this din from Shmuel, because his Rabbi Shmuel said exactly that. So if Rabbi Yehuda's passing this way, it's definitely based on what Shmuel said. And therefore, I would assume that what Shmuel said is correct. That memra is correct. And dina machuta dina, I'm not going to deal with that. Amalei, dora de riuta kamart. You're speaking about either that specific location or these village of shepherds. Hatam bage mitamre havu. Those were hidden properties. Dinu gufayu lo aviyave taska lamalka. They weren't paying the property taxes to the king. They were hiding these properties because they didn't want the government to know about them. Because if the government found out about them, they'd compel them to pay taxes. So they were tax evading and using the properties improperly. Because they didn't have a right to use the property because they weren't paying the taxes. So they were tax evading and then using the properties. Umalka amar. And the king says, Mandu yoiv taska lechulara. Whoever pays the taxes has the right to the land. So there are two ways to review this. The way that the Rishbam explains is that the second guy who came along and took possession of it in that interim stage, he intended to pay the taxes. So since he intended to pay the taxes, he becomes the owner, according to the king, of the property. On the other hand, the other way that people view it is that the owners, the Rabbeinu Gershom, knows that the people themselves didn't own the land to sell it. The goy was not the true owner or proper owner of the land, because he didn't pay the taxes. So when he sold it to you, he sold you something that he didn't own. And that's why when the second party came in and took possession of it, he was taking possession of Hefker. There was no owner prior to this because the government didn't grant them the rights of ownership. And that's why he was allowed to intervene. So what he's saying is, don't bring me a proof from that case law, because that case law is unique to that circumstance and you can't prove anything about Shmuel's position. Ravuna zaben ara miobid kochavim. Ravuna purchased property from Obed Kochavim. Ati Yisrael Acher, Rafik Bapurta. And another Jew came along, and in that interim stage, the no man's land, between the time that the money was given and the shtar was yet to be given, he came in there and he worked the land. Atta the kamei Rav Nachman, came to Rav Nachman, ukmei biyode. He gave him the property. He gave the second guy the right to the property. Amalei madadech. So he said to him, why are you paskening against me? Rav Huna says to Rav Nachman, why are you paskening against me? Damar Shmuel? You're saying because of Shmuel's din, nichsei ove kuchavei marein kamid bar. So what are you saying? That's the reason that you gave it to him is because of Shmuel's psak. Then, Levid Leimark, eat after Shmuel. Paskin like the other din of Shmuel, which was the din that we started out at the bottom of the previous amud, which is the machlok between Rav and Shmuel, when you take possession of the Nixay Ager, and you do a little hoeing or a little action in there, is that sufficient to take possession of the property? The answer was, according to Rav, yes. According to Shmuel, it's not. So since, if you're gonna passing like Shmuel across the board. Yes, okay, so he has a right to take possession of the property before me, but he'll only get what he hold on, because he doesn't get the whole property then. He's only entitled to the area that he hold. He says, I passing like you over there. Because who brought the memra in the name of Rav over there? It was a machloka between Shmuel and Rav. Who was the position that brought Rav's position down? He says, Amar Rav Huna, Amar Rav. He says, you brought the memra in the name of Rav, and I'm going to pass him like you over there. Which is, Damar Rav Huna, Amar Rav, Kdevin Shadikesh Bamakush Echad Kanakula. So yes, I'm going to pass him like Shmuel with regards to it being a midbar and the right to go and intervene and take the property from you, but I'm going to pass him like you, who believes that if you do one makush, you get the whole property. So therefore, when this guy came in, it was Rafik Bapurta, he hoed it a little bit, he took possession of the whole property, and he disengaged you from the property, and now you can't take possession of the property. So now, Sholach Ravuna Bar Avin, Yisrael Sholachach Sadeh Movi Kochavim, Vayisrael Acher Vechzik Ba. So exactly our case, so he bought a property from a non-Jew, and another Jew intervenes and takes possession after the money's been paid, but before the shtar has been given over. Ein Motzino Tami Yado. We don't remove it from him, meaning that he has a right to stay there. All the Amoraim agree to this position or paskening like Shmuel in this case. Now, if you go back to the Rashbam earlier, the Rashbam quotes the Rabbeinu Hananel, who says that the halacha here is not like Shmuel. Halacha is not like Shmuel. Why? Because Abaye asked a question from the other position of Shmuel, which is Dina de Machuta, Dina. And Rav Yosef didn't have an answer for him. He didn't have an answer. He said to him, look, I have case law. And even that case law was overturned because Abaye says you can't extrapolate from that case law. It was a unique circumstance. Based on that, the Rabbeinu Hananel says halacha is not like Shmuel over here, because you've undermined his position. So he quotes it, Perish Rabbeinu Hananel, the late Hilchot of Shmuel because of that. It says, Veli Nira, the Rashbam says, the Hilchot of Kishmuel. The Locha is like Shmuel. Why? Da Rav Nachman de Dina, Habib Hilchot of Kavateh, Bidine, Dan Kavateh. Rav Nachman over here, Paskin like Shmuel. So number one, Rav Nachman is a Talmud of Shmuel, and he's Paskin like Shmuel. Number two is that Rav Nachman, when it comes to dinim, gets extra power in terms of Pesach Halacha, because he was an expert Dayan. When he does something that involves Dayanut, we abide by his position. And here he paskin like Shmuel. In addition, all the Amoraim we saw at the end of the sugya today, also paskin like Shmuel. Therefore, the Halacha is like Shmuel. Ah, what are you going to do about the fact that there's a stira in Shmuel's position between Dina Malchut and Dina and the Shmuel statement? Says, he had an answer for that. He says, I don't know what Shmuel said, but I want to bring you a case law. He didn't bother to answer Abaye's question, even though he had an answer, because he had case law that proved that Shmuel really held of that. And you can't dismiss that position of Shmuel. So what the Rashbam speculates is that Rav Yosef had a way to reconcile between Dina de Malchuta Dina and the issue of the exchange over here. It could be that the Dina de Malchuta Dina supersedes the Din Torah in this case of the Goy relinquishing control once he gets the money, because Dina de Malchuta Dina requires a shtar. And all you say is Shmuel's position was stated in a place where there wasn't that din of the malchut. So that might be the simple answer. So the Rashbam later explains, Vaidakashale din of the malchut, the din of Rav Yosef, lo svirle haidamar Abaye. He does not agree with Abaye says, de malka amar lo leichulara elo bishtara, de lav din of the malchuti, elo bchazaka nami leichul, that you can acquire the property not only through a shtar, but also through a chazaka. So it says that it was a machloka de mitziut between Rav Yosef and Abaye as to exactly what the din of the malchut of Dina was. And therefore, Rav Yosef can overcome the stira in Shmuel, because the Dina de Malchut de Dina is not in contradiction to the other position of Shmuel, according to Rav Yosef. Whereas for Abaye, it was a problem, but Rav Yosef didn't bother to answer him because he didn't think it was an issue, and he brought him the case law to prove that Shmuel really held that way. Again, I think the easier answer is just to say that it depends on the area that you're in. Shmuel's din might be true in a place where the Dina de Malchut de Dina doesn't supersede it. And so therefore that din will be true, as long as there's no din of Malchut Dina that says that Ishtar is the mechanism for acquisition and prevents you from having that twilight zone between the time that the Goy gives up ownership and the Jew takes possession of the property. And therefore, they both paskin, the Bible says, when the Rashi paskin like Shmuel in this instance. Okay, we're going to stop here. 8 lines down on the top of Nimhei Omid Aleph.